Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today's guest, Diane Ravitch, spent many years as a leading conservative education advocate. She was Assistant Secretary of Education under George H.W. Bush and believed in charter schools, standardized testing, vouchers, and No Child Left Behind. And then she saw what happened when those policies were put into practice, and she changed her views. In her new memoir, In Education, How I Changed My Mind About Schools and Almost Everything Else, Diane Ravitch writes, "This is a book about my life, about admitting I was wrong, and about how important it is to say it out loud. For many years, I advocated strongly for certain ideas in the field of education. I felt sure such policies would produce higher test scores. But when I saw what happened after they were put into practice, I discovered that they did not work and had bad consequences for students, teachers, and communities. I was wrong. I admitted I was wrong. I said it in writing and in public. In our opinionated and polarized world, people don't do that. But I realized the importance of admitting error, of keeping an open mind, and regularly looking at evidence, of listening to people with whom I disagree." Diane Ravitch is an education historian and co-founder and president of the Network for Public Education. She was a research professor of education at New York University from 1995 to 2020, assistant secretary of education under George H.W. Bush, and national testing board member during the Clinton administration. Diane Ravitch is the author of several books, including Reign of Error, The Hoax of the Privatization Movement and the Danger to America's Public Schools. Her latest book is An Education, How I Changed My Mind About Schools and Almost Everything Else. Hi, Diane. Congratulations on your latest book, and thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you. It's such a great pleasure to be with you.
Well, it's great to have you back, Diane. It was so interesting to learn about your life. You've been on our show many times, and we have really good conversations about your transformation and your fight for public schools, but I didn't know much about you beyond that. And it was so interesting to learn about your life as a child in Houston, Texas. You grew up in a Democratic family. You and your family experienced horrible anti-Semitism. You write about racism and segregation in your community, your marriage, your divorce, meeting your now wife, Mary. Why did you decide to write such a personal book?
You know, it's funny. I have wanted to write this book for a very long time. And I have found, while I was cleaning up my documents the other day, that I actually started it a few years before I actually started it. I wanted to tell the story because I thought, you know, everyone has their own story. And I felt that there were things about my story, growing up in Houston in a family of eight children, and taking the path that I did and the decisions that I made, that it was a story worth telling. And I decided that even if no one wanted to publish it, I would, if need be, I would self-publish it, because I wanted so much to tell the story, to know that my children and my grandchildren would know who I was. Mm-hmm. And so it really came out of a personal need on my part. I've been saying, warning about privatization of public schools now since 2010, when my book came out called The Death and Life of the Great American School System, How Testing and Choice Are Undermining Education. So for 15 years, I have been saying it's sometimes bipartisan, but certainly now very Trumpian. They want to destroy public education. They want to destroy public schools. And it's coming true in a way that's even more horrible than I imagined. But I said, I can't write that book again. I've already said that. I have to tell my story.
You also revisit some very difficult moments in your life. What was that like for you?
Well, in some cases, painful. There are things that I wrote in this book that I have literally never told anyone because they were so painful. And I did not tell my husband. I did not tell my wife. But I told the story, this, the story of being sexually abused by my father. I told the book, and I told it in the book in detail. And even they were, well, my husband is now dead, but he would have been shocked. And my wife, Mary, was indeed shocked and outraged.
You know, Diane, when I read that part of the book, I just had to put it down. And I wish that we were in person, because I just wanted to give you a big hug. I mean, just knowing all of the incredible work that you've done and that you had to endure that, that was just so heartbreaking to read.
Well, that plus the fact that I had abortions and didn't want to, which basically destroyed my marriage. And that was painful to tell, because that, again, I had told a few very close friends, but certainly never told the world. And in telling my story, in order to, for it all to make sense, I felt I had to be brutally honest with myself and to my readers.
How has your family and your close friends responded?
Well, they're just starting to read it. As part of my divorce settlement with my ex-husband, I agreed not to write about him. I think it says not to write about him in his lifetime, but in any event, I consider that clause to be out. And as I said in the book, he really compelled me to have abortions. He didn't want any more children, and I passionately did. And when I reminded him about this, the last time we had lunch together, about a year before he died, he didn't remember it. It was such an important thing in my life, and he had already forgotten it. My family has been very understanding, and so far, nobody has been completely shocked. I guess they were shocked when they were reading some of these things, but they've been very supportive.
The other thing that was interesting about your book is, because you worked as Assistant Secretary of Education under George H.W. Bush, it's very easy to assume that you were a Republican, but that's not the case. You grew up in a Democratic family. You're a Democrat, or were a Democrat. I don't know if you still are. And you wrote about all of these. You have such an incredible life. I mean, you write about marching, going to the March on Washington. You met Bayard Rustin. You married into a wealthy and influential family. And your book also almost reads like a history book, Diane, because you have met so many incredible activists and politicians across the board.
Well, you know, this morning I was writing a piece on my blog about the demolition of the East Wing of the White House, which absolutely stunned and shocked me. Mm-hmm. And I started thinking about how many times I had been in the White House. And the first time was a state dinner given by Lyndon B. Johnson. And then I was in the White House when Gerald Ford, and I mentioned this in the book, when Gerald Ford was president, I was there for a lunch with just the president and two other people. And then I was in the White House when Reagan was president and told jokes, and he was very funny. And I was, you know, I didn't put all of that into the blog piece because it was too distracting to the point I was trying to make, which was that I had such reverence for that house, every inch of it. I had this feeling of walking on hallowed ground, of walking in the same steps as so many of our presidents and you know, major figures. And I can't imagine pulling up a wrecking crew, you know, the weekend or the day after the No Kings weekend, and starting to demolish a part of the building. Because to me, the building was sacrosanct. And I remember the last time I was there, Bill Clinton was president, and we walked into the White House, my wife and I, and the Marine Band was playing from the Sound of Music, Edelweiss. And she started crying because her parents had been immigrants in the Weimar years. They had come from Germany and Austria. And she had, they're both dead now, but she had this feeling of, oh, if only my parents could see me now, the Marine Band playing Edelweiss. And she was weeping. And I have that weepy feeling every time I've set foot in the White House of being in the presence of history. And then to see this history treated so callously, it made me sick, frankly.
I'm just looking at your blog. It's dianeravitch.net. And you have these two photos. Wow. I mean, they're completely demolishing the East Wing, as you write, to replace it with a ballroom for 999 people. The ballroom will be larger than the White House. You write, Trump does not understand that the White House belongs to the people, not to him. He said the ballroom wouldn't interfere with the White House. He lied. He has no respect for the White House or its history. And as you say, you wrote, this makes me sick. It makes me sick.
And it makes me angry. And I just wonder whether in the future, you know, hopefully he won't be president forever, but in the future, will every other president respect the Trump ballroom, or will they seek to restore the White House as it was? And, you know, who knows? I certainly don't know. But I understand he's also planning to build a triumphal arch, sort of like the Arc de Triomphe. But in his case, it'll be the Arc de Trump facing the Lincoln Memorial. And his ego is out of control, I guess. But, you know, no one can stop him. He has absolute authority.
Well, and that's, I was going to ask you, given your background, you've worked under several administrations, you've had contact with so many politicians. Did you ever think that something like this would happen so quickly in the United States? We just started a new series called The Authoritarian Playbook. It's a weekly series. And most of our guests said that they have been shocked by how quickly things are moving.
Well, you know what? I have to say that I'm kind of on both sides of this, because I'm shocked at the collapse of public loyalty to the norms of American life, the norms in which politicians respected the process. That seems to have vanished for the moment. And I was reminded when this question came up the other day, and I was reminded of an English political philosopher named Walter Bagehot. And he said, one of the great things about democracy is that in a sense, it doesn't really matter if someone loses the election, because they know it's like the roll of the dice, and there'll always be another election, and they'll have another chance, and both sides accept the rules of the game. And this is an administration that does not accept any of the rules of the game, and he's determined just to plunge ahead and do whatever he wants and see if the courts stop him. And so far, the lower courts have stopped him, and then it reaches the Supreme Court. And they say, yeah, go ahead, do it, whatever it is. Send troops into Portland, send troops into LA. This is just beyond understanding. So in one sense, I'm completely shocked that it's happening. In another sense, I think back to American history, to the times where the Ku Klux Klan marched in the streets of different cities, held a rally in Madison Square Garden, held rallies all over the country, and people didn't think it remarkable to have a Ku Klux Klan and men in white hoods influencing their politics and seeking their votes for their candidates. I think about the McCarthy era and how McCarthy ran roughshod over people's rights. And it reminds me that there has always been this element in American society that wanted to turn back anything that happened that was progressive, that helped ordinary people. And it goes back certainly to the FDR administration in the 1930s, when very wealthy plutocrats, as Roosevelt called them, were trying to roll back all the New Deal reforms like Social Security and anything that helped ordinary people. And you can take it even further back to periods where nativists wanted to exclude immigrants. There was a tremendous anti-immigrant feeling in the 1920s, and immigration was in fact shut down during the 1920s and restricted only to basically to Europeans. So I think that there is this long history, and anyone who studied American history knows that the anti-immigrant feeling, the racist feelings, the anti-Semitism, the anti-Catholicism, certainly the homophobia, all of this is deeply embedded in our history. But I think that what has shocked me and so many other people is we thought we were moving forward and away from that part of our legacy, the racist. And what we understand is that fascism requires having enemies. And whenever a politician arises who begins demonizing some part of the population, whether it's immigrants or Catholics or Jews or homosexuals, that's fascism. And in normal democratic politics, hatred is not an organizing point, but it is today.
And all of this you saw with your own eyes, Diane. In your new book, In Education, you wrote, "Education was my path to a new life with new opportunities. I was raised in a racist, conservative milieu, but I considered myself a liberal, a true blue Democrat. My parents always voted for the Democratic candidate. They loved FDR and credited him with ending the Depression. My parents were less racist than most white people in Houston back then. We children were never allowed to say the N-word, but they were racist. Racism and segregation were deeply embedded in the culture around them. They expected that Black people would never enter the house through the front door, and they were never disturbed by the fact that Black people were not allowed to go to the same movie theaters, schools, or restaurants as white people." You write, "Is it woke to look back on that era with a sense of shame? I do." And then you also write about Brown v. Board, and that decision came out in May 1954 at the end of your sophomore year in high school. I mean, what's incredible about your story, Diane, in your book is you've experienced and you've seen so much, and you've really changed your thinking in your 60s. And we'll talk more about that. And then you look at where we are today and how, in some cases, many people in this country would like to go back to these times.
Yes, indeed. This is true. I think that what Trump has enabled has been to pick up the rock under which so many people were hiding their views. And he has made it possible and not quite respectable, but nonetheless possible and okay for people to say openly racist, sexist, all sorts of things that were simply not said. I mean, it would have been considered disgraceful in public life to say the things that he says every day. The video that he ran on No King's Day was shocking, shocking. And Mike Johnson said, "Oh, it's just humor." Well, you don't expect to see a president of the United States in a video of himself dumping feces all over crowds of Americans. That is not funny. I guess it's funny to the haters, but that is just another sign of encouraging hatred and ridiculing people who disagree with you. What I was trying to exemplify in this book is how it's possible, if you are willing to learn, to change your views, and not with violence, but through listening. There are a couple of quotes in there where I quoted, for instance, Robert Hutchins, who was a very famous president of the University of Chicago, and he said, don't stop listening to your enemies because you have to consider that they may be right. And so it's very hard for me to say that I'm doing that with the Trump people, because so much of what they say is hateful, and I don't find it useful to listen to hateful rhetoric. But when people are reasonable and willing to talk, it's important to listen.
Today, we're speaking with Diane Ravitch, an education historian, co-founder and president of the Network for Public Education. She was Assistant Secretary of Education under George H.W. Bush and National Testing Board member during the Clinton administration. Her new book is out today. It's called In Education, How I Changed My Mind About Schools and Almost Everything Else. If you have any questions for Diane Ravitch, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. If you work in public education, if you have children in public education, and you'd like to talk about what concerns you the most about what we're facing right now, ProPublica has a number of important pieces out about what's happening under the Trump administration. One is these activists want to dismantle public schools, and now they run the education department. And then Diane Ravitch has been writing about these issues for many, many years. She's got a couple of pieces in the New York Review, Selling Out Our Public Schools. And you can find these pieces at KALW.org. Click news and then your call. Diane, before we get to calls and emails, can you talk about your transformation? You write, despite my decades of immersion in conservative circles, I experienced an intellectual and emotional epiphany when I was in my late 60s, certainly late in life for such a transformation. I struggled with my beliefs and ultimately moved philosophically and politically from right to left. So talk a bit about how this all happened.
Well, my transformation began with my understanding of education issues, especially my recognition that so many of the things that I had advocated were not working and were hurting kids and hurting public schools and hurting America and democracy. And I'm speaking specifically here about the current or the longtime passion for standardized testing. Which I go into great detail about how I came to feel that it's basically a rigged system, the standardized testing. They don't mean it to be rigged, but it is. And the other thing was my understanding as I got older that charter schools, which I had supported, I had written articles supporting them. I had testified in the New York State legislature in favor of charter school legislation, but I came to see that they were, in fact, a disaster, and that the only bigger disaster as time went by was vouchers. So it was evidence that persuaded me that I was wrong. And once I saw I was wrong about these kinds of issues, I began to think differently. And I find myself today that the best description politically that I can find is that I am, to use a term that's much disparaged, I'm woke, and I'm not embarrassed about it. And I say early on in the book, Jesus was woke. And this is kind of ironic because the biggest anti-woke figures identify themselves as being Christian, and their views are not Christian at all. In fact, I was trying to explain to someone the expression Republican Jesus, and I discovered that it's actually in Wikipedia. And if you look at Republican Jesus in Wikipedia, Republican Jesus basically says, if you have a problem, take care of it yourself. And, you know, I'm Jewish, but I still identify with Jesus as someone who was woke. And I believe as he did, and he's quoted as saying in the New Testament, feed the hungry, tend to the sick, clothe those who need clothing, and welcome the stranger. I think that the Pope reiterated that just recently. I like Pope Leo a lot. So I'd say that that's a pretty big transformation. I think that the Republican Party has fallen into a deep, deep hole. I used to have great respect for it because I shared some of their views in terms of their respect for norms and traditions, and I felt comfortable working in the George H.W. administration because President George H.W. Bush, you can criticize him on lots of grounds, but he was not a cruel man, and he was sensitive to other people. And he really thought that he could make life better for people. And there was also, even going back to Nixon created the Environmental Protection Agency. And that's one of many that are now being dismantle. George H.W. Bush was very big on foreign aid. That has been canceled completely. So the Republican Party that I grew up with was responsible, willing to take care of people, at least to an extent. And that's not the Republican Party anymore. We have instead the Trump Party, and it's cruel. And I don't understand. I know where it fits in American history. It fits in with the tradition of nativism and the Ku Klux Klan and all of those people who wanted to roll back the progressive reforms of the entire 20th century.
We're going to take a quick break. Today, we're spending the hour with Diane Ravitch, education historian who served as Assistant Secretary of Education under George H.W. Bush. Her new memoir is out today, An Education, How I Changed My Mind About Schools and Almost Everything Else. You can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we're spending the hour with Diane Ravitch, an education historian who spent many years as a leading conservative education advocate. And then she saw what happened when policies like charter schools, standardized testing, vouchers, No Child Left Behind were put into practice, and she changed her views. She's out with a new book. It's out today, An Education, How I Changed My Mind About Schools and Almost Everything Else. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. And before we get to calls, Diane, I played that song. I don't know if everyone heard it because we're on other stations. It's called If I Can Dream. And it was written by Walter Earl Brown for Elvis Presley. And Walter Earl Brown said he wrote that because he understood Presley's hatred of racial injustice. And you write in your book that you really liked Elvis. And so we played that for you. But I also just wanted to ask you, I mean, you have so many interesting stories about segregation and the racism that you experienced growing up in Houston. And to think that it was your sophomore year when Brown v. Board came down, and you wrote, our schools were segregated. The Houston School Board was determined to preserve segregation and fought the decision. The court's decision was never discussed in your class, but of course you had access to newspapers, radio, and TV. And then you also write about attending the March on Washington.
Yes, indeed. One of the things that I look back on with sadness is that I never knew a Black student my own age. I don't think that I knew any Hispanic students because they were not admitted into the regular schools. There were separate schools where Blacks and Hispanics went to school together, and the white schools were white schools. And at the time, it wasn't upsetting because I wasn't aware of what I didn't know. But when I learned about the Brown decision, I went to see our principal, and he said, you know, if we were to integrate the school, so many Black principals and Black teachers would lose their jobs. And I thought, well, that didn't sound like a reason to defy the Supreme Court. But it wasn't the reason they resisted the court. They resisted the court because the board was racist and didn't want any desegregation at all. And so I graduated of a segregated school system in 1956 and went to Wellesley, where there was not a single Black student in my class. And it's interesting to me that when I go back for reunion, as I do every 5 years, because I love Wellesley, the classes have become more and more diverse. There are now probably half the students are white and the other half are all different backgrounds, Black, Hispanic, Asian, you name it, and incredible, incredible young women. So I'm very impressed because with each passing year since I left, the school has increased its commitment to diversity. And one of the points that I make in the book is that this Trump administration war on diversity, inclusion, and equity is simply a passing thing. I mean, he is asking people to deny reality. We are a diverse country. I think what he's saying is not that we're not diverse, but that he doesn't want any institution to have any programs to help kids who have suffered from discrimination in their lifetimes or their parents in their lifetimes. And having grown up under segregation and seen the devastating impact that it had on so many Black families, I think that's ridiculous. And I think that in time we will see his policies go into the garbage can. And I don't know if we'll call it DEI in the future, but we will have DEI because it's just and it's right.
And it seems like you got into education and learning about and writing education after meeting a member of the Black Power, movement. Your son was a baby and you really wanted to figure out what to write about. And your friend Mae Shane introduced you to Preston Wilcox, a Black social worker and community organizer. You write, he was a brilliant, militant, warm, and devoted to the Black Power movement. And he brought you to community meetings in Harlem, where you were the only white person in the room, and you listened to angry parents express their rage about the bureaucracy of the New York City public schools. And it seems like that's when you really took an interest in the school system.
Yes, that is true. And I was at that time, and that would have been in the mid-1960s, 1967 or so. I was at that time recovering from the death of my 2-year-old who died of leukemia. And I was really looking for a career. I didn't know what it would be, but I knew it would be a writing career. And I was just absorbing knowledge. And my friend Mae Shane was a social worker. She was from Nashville, Tennessee, and very liberal. And she introduced me to Preston Wilcox. Preston Wilcox was a very exciting figure who he was a leader of the community control movement. And he believed that Black communities should control their own destiny. And he was very kind to include me because I learned so much going to community meetings and learning about how frustrated people felt about their powerlessness and the fact that decisions were made by bureaucracies without any input from the community. So I was much influenced by that. But I also came to understand what a complicated situation it was when the strikes began breaking out and the community control movement came into direct conflict with the integration movement. And the union was on the teachers union, which was very powerful politically, was in alliance with the integration movement. And Bayard Rustin was one of the few Black leaders in New York who stood up for integration and against community control. And so it was a tremendous learning experience for me. And it also introduced me to the complexities of the New York City public school system. And I hadn't gone to New York City public schools. I had gone to the Houston public schools. But I got so fascinated with the school system and how it was that one bureaucracy controlled the education of 1 million children and how they were going to maneuver through these conflicting demands for integration and community control. And so I was working at the time in a part-time job for the Carnegie Corporation. And that also led me to meet with the leaders of different Black Power groups, aside from those that Preston Wilcox introduced me to. And I became interested in the New York City schools and decided that I would write an article about the New York City schools and their history, about which I didn't know enough. But I started reading about the history and thinking, this is really a great story. And I proposed an article to a friend who was an editor at the New York Times Magazine. And he basically said, you don't know what you're talking about. You've never published a book. You've only published little bitty articles. And he said something that was so insulting that I never forgot it. He wrote a note rejecting my proposal for an article. And he said, if you ever write an article called I Danced with My Dentist, I'll consider that. And I could only understand that as a sexist put down. Because he would never have written that to a man. I mean, it was ridiculous. But I decided, well, I'm going to write a book about the New York City school system. So that was my first book, The History of the New York City Public Schools. I spent years working on it. I started in 1967, and it was published in 1974. But I had, at that time, 2 young children, and I could only write, like, after they were both in bed and nothing, I wasn't going out with my husband. And so my working hours were usually from 11 to 2. And I'd spend my days in the library and I would write very late at night. and then be up early to take care of the children. So it took a long time to get that book written. But when it came out, it was immediately recognized because it was new. It was different, the history of a school system. And I had a lot to say in that. It was very well reviewed, including in the New York Times Book Review. And suddenly people began calling me to write articles about schools. And that was the beginning of my career. So it was several years after I graduated college, actually almost 15 years graduating after I graduated college. And that's when I decided, I think I need to get a PhD. And that was another story where I went to see the president of Teachers College, Columbia University, and said, I want to get a PhD. And he said, oh, you don't need one. And that summer, he went off to Stanford, where he spent every summer at the Stanford Center for Behavioral Sciences. And he ran into his old friend, Bruno Bettelheim. And Bruno Bettelheim had read one of my articles. And he said, is this young lady getting a PhD? And my friend Larry Crimmon, my mentor, said, oh, no, I've told her she doesn't need a PhD. And he said, will you please tell her from me that if she doesn't have a PhD, she will hit a glass ceiling and she will not be able to break through it. So when Larry Crimmon returned from his California vacation, he told me this is a message from Bruno Bettelheim. And I said, I think he's right. I'm going to get a PhD. And he said, well, you're doing it against my advice. And I did register for a PhD and, in fact, studied, took classes, and got a PhD.
Wow, really incredible stories. Today, we're talking with Diane Ravitch, who's out with a new book. It's out today. It's called An Education, How I Changed My Mind About Schools and Almost Everything Else. Diane Ravitch spent many years as a leading advocate for conservative education policies. And then she saw what happened when those policies were put into practice, and she changed her views. Let's hear from a few callers, and we've got some emails. Let's go to Sam in San Francisco. Hi, Sam. Thank you for holding.
Hi. I'm a special education advocate and parent organizer who collaborates very closely with the teachers' unions. And I would love to hear your advice on the best way to communicate to parents and policymakers about special education, especially if they've already bought into privatization and don't understand that the teachers' unions are not the enemy. And many of them are actually liberals with ties to the charter movement. And we literally had a discussion last night about how much data should we use in trying to convince people that this is a crisis that is going to affect everyone. The data around the Individuals with Disability Education Act is really startling. And so I'm just curious of what sort of communication changed your mind, or maybe folks that you've seen get their minds changed. I would love to hear that. Thank you.
Thank you, Sam. And feel free to stay on the line in case you have a follow-up.
Okay. Thank you. I'll just mention that in 2012, after the publication of my first turnaround book, The Death and Life of the Great American School System, I toured California promoting the book and talking about privatization. And I made an appointment to talk with George Lakoff. And George Lakoff is a linguist at Berkeley. And I said, how do you convince people, how do you reach people about what's happening to the schools, this charter movement and all these lies that are being told about the schools? And he said, liberals make the mistake of thinking that people are persuaded by data. And so they try to be rational and have data and they don't get heard. What conservatives do is tell stories. They tell stories about individuals and families that were affected, and that's more persuasive than data. And he said the conservative outlook starts from the point of view of father knows best. So you go with authority and you go with stories. I mean, the conservatives go with authority, but they also use stories to tell their tale. And I have heard from many parents of children with disabilities that their kids were not admitted to charter schools. I know that there are charter schools that are special or that specialize in kids with disabilities with autism or other disabilities, and maybe they get a better education there. But for the most part, charter schools are incentivized to prove that they have higher test scores than public schools. And the way they do that is by not accepting kids with disabilities, not accepting kids who come in with low scores. So if you keep out kids with disabilities, if you keep out the kids with low scores, if you kick out the kids with behavior problems, you could have very high test scores. And then they get bragging rights about their test scores. So I think it's very important to tell these stories, but it's also very important, and I think in California, to tell the stories of graft, of the grifters who've used the charter schools to make millions and millions of dollars. The organization that I'm president of and co-founded with the California school teacher is called the Network for Public Education. On our website, we have something called Charter School Scandals, and it's, you can look at them by state, and California has more scandals, I think, than any other state. The most recent and the most, the largest scandal probably in the United States was an online charter chain that claimed to be providing services, and most of their students were ghost students, meaning there were no students. And they were required to, I think, repay a couple of $100 million, but there were no services provided, and they were collecting money as if they were. And there have been many similar scandals, not on that scale, in California, where people were paid to run schools where they excluded students with disabilities and kicked out the kids with low test scores. And we've seen this all over the country. So take a look at the Network for Public Education website, and particularly at the charter school scandals, and it will, I think, curl your hair.
Are you still on the line with us, Sam?
Yeah.
What are you hearing from people about education today?
So I will say the special education community is terrified right now. It's a life and death situation. As far as, you know, next year, I think the money situation is going to be so dire that children are not going to be receiving services. And a lot of these sort of services sort of borderline on medical services, right? Like speech, occupational therapy, physical therapy that they get through the schools. And there's legal obligations, although now that the special ed department, it's been gutted from the federal, we don't actually know that our IEPs, our individual education plans, that are contracts that are protected under federal law, if they're going to be honored. I think, you know, as far as the groups that I'm working with, we really need the state of California to step in and fill these holes financially. There's a few things politically that we're trying to push to make that happen, Prop 50 and then Prop 13 reform, you know, to get the money back into the system. But we also need our local politicians to just, you know, money solves a lot of this problem. And we need, you know, staffing to be consistent, and so that you have to pay people to train and to be available. So, yeah, we're looking at a fiscal cliff that is, I'm not exaggerating when I say it's life and death for these children and these families. The independence is, you know, going to be under question, where there may have been more independence For individuals. Is it's hard to describe this crisis and get your hands around it.
Wow.
Well, yeah.
Sam, I'm so sorry this is happening. Thank you for calling, and we'll definitely do more shows about this. Diane, there's a piece. Thank you, Sam. Oh, sure, Diane.
What the Trump administration wants to do, and this was in the booklet called, or the book called Project 2025, is they want to turn over the special education money and the Title I money to the states and say to them, these are now your funds. Do with them as you will. In other words, the money that was really dedicated to kids with special needs will become block grants, and the block grants will not be will not be dedicated to what you think they should be dedicated to. And that's going to be your first fight, is to make sure that the money that comes in is used for the purposes that you anticipated.
And just for some more information on this, NPR had a piece about the Trump administration gutting the department overseeing special education amid the shutdown. This came out last week. And NPR's Corey Turner reports that the reduction in force affects dozens of staff members responsible for $15 billion in special education funding and for making sure states provide special education services to the country's 7.5 million children with disabilities. One department employee who spoke with NPR, who requested anonymity for fear of retribution, said this is decimating the office responsible for safeguarding the rights of infants, toddlers, children, and youth with disabilities. So there's that story. And then the other one, and you have been writing about this for so many years, Diane, ProPublica has a piece about how the Department of Education is bringing in activists who are hostile to public schools. They report it could mean a new era of private and religious schools boosted by tax dollars and the end of public schools as we know them. And we're getting a lot of emails from listeners saying, what can we do to save our public schools from all of this?
Well, I'd say that, first of all, ProPublica is absolutely right. Linda McMahon, the Secretary of Education, was part of a group called the America First Policy Institute, and it's hostile to public schools. So we have, as Trump in his first administration had,
DeVos.
Betsy DeVos, the billionaire from Michigan. Mm. She was a tremendous supporter of vouchers and very hostile to public schools. And you will hear from them only negative things about public schools. And the reality is vouchers have been a tremendous failure. And in most states, in every state with vouchers, the story has been the same. Most of the vouchers go to the kids already in private and religious schools or homeschooling. Arkansas just brought out a report the other day, 88% of vouchers are going to kids who never attended a public school. So what we're seeing with the voucher movement is a giveaway where the state commits to support every child now in private and religious school, as well as homeschooling parents. And the voucher movement has been moving rapidly to remove all income limits so that even the wealthiest parents are entitled to collect $8,000 or $10,000 to subsidize their tuition in these private schools. And it is a dire situation. And it's not going to get better because these people will be there for another 3 years. And I'd say that the most important thing that can be done now is to mobilize for 26 and make sure that there are that there's a Democratic Congress to try to slow down or stop this anti-public school activities. And within the community itself, the most important thing is to make people aware of what's going on, because a lot of people just don't understand that what they're trying to do is not slash the funding for special education, but to remove it and say to the states, do with it as you will. Use it for some other purpose. You might choose to put it into, who knows, money for the National Guard, which is occupying Portland or whatever it may be. I mean, thank goodness for California. California and New York have both been stalwart in terms of their opposition to this Trump madness, but they are trying to tear down the whole social safety net. And the public schools are not just part of the social safety net, they're part of the foundation of our democracy. And one can go back to the founding fathers, and they spoke very laudably about the importance of having the children of rich and poor going to school together. And what they really meant was not just rich and poor, but kids of all kind learning together, because they would grow up in a society where they would work together. And that's part of our democratic idea. So the attack on public schools is an attack on our democracy. And people don't understand it because it's somehow abstract. But when it comes down to your own child, what you must do is fight for public schools. Go to the legislature, make sure you combat the Charter School Association. The California Charter School Association is one of the richest lobbies in the state of California, and they have done everything possible to eliminate accountability and to allow charter schools maximum flexibility, unlike the public schools, which get burdened with more accountability than the private schools have. So stand up for public education, keep your kids in public schools. You have to understand, and I really recommend that you look at the materials on the Network for Public Education website, as well as some of the books that I've written, Reign of Error, for instance. The lies that are told about public schools have to be understood. Public schools are open to everyone. Charter schools are not open to everyone. Voucher schools are not open to everyone. The vouchers have been a failure. They don't improve performance. The kids who leave public schools to go to voucher schools actually lose ground. Their scores on tests go down because the voucher schools don't have certified teachers. So I could go on, but I think you get the point. Neither charters nor vouchers have been a good replacement for public schools. There is nothing that can replace public schools except other public schools. This is a massive raid on the public treasury on behalf of privatization. And privatization has never made for better services. It always leads to some people getting rich off the public dime and some kids losing opportunity, not gaining opportunity.
Diane Ravitch is an education historian and co-founder and president of the Network for Public Education. She's out with a new book, out today, In Education, How I Changed My Mind About Schools and Almost Everything Else. Diane, we have a number of people emailing us who just wanted to say thank you. Philip writes, your words are thrilling me, and I wish they could be broadcast to everyone who needs to hear them. So thank you so much, Diane, for all of your work. It was really great to learn so much about you. Thank you for joining us, and we'd love to have you back.
Thank you. It was a great pleasure. And please send me a copy so I can post it on my website and my blog.
We will. Thank you. And have a great time on your book tour. Thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering our show today. And thank you so much for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.